Okay, so imagine the economy right now as a puzzle. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Rima Khreis, in for Kai Rizdal. It is Tuesday, October 11th. Good to have you along. The economy is kind of a weird puzzle right now, right? Like, who knows where a lot of the pieces are? But we do have some of them. We know interest rates are rising, the job market is robust, and in the next week or so, the picture will become even clearer after big banks, airlines, and consumer-facing companies report their third-quarter earnings. And today, we got this. The Optimism Index from the National Federation of Independent Business. Believe it or not, small business confidence went up for the third straight month. Inflation and labor are their biggest gripes. But there was one thing that stood out to us. More than half of all small businesses, 56%, have made capital expenditures in the last 6 months, buying equipment for their production lines or more vehicles for a service fleet. That's the highest since March of this year. And while it's below pre-pandemic levels, Marketplace's Justin Ho explains how that's still a pretty telling puzzle piece.
For some businesses, capital expenditures can be about trying to survive in a tough market. That's the story at 21st Amendment Brewery in the San Francisco Bay Area.
We actually bought 8 new fermenting vessels.
That's Nico Freccia, the brewery's co-founder. He says beer sales have struggled this year. Consumers are cutting back, and competition keeps growing. So his new vessels will let the brewery start branching out beyond craft beer and into things like non-alcoholic beer and hop water.
You know, we are realizing, like a lot of small brewers, that you're not necessarily going to continue to grow your business significantly just with craft beer. So you have to expand into other areas.
More equipment can help a business work around the tight labor market, too.
We have had a big challenge getting staff. So, you know, more equipment does make you more efficient. It does potentially make it easier to operate with fewer people.
Small businesses usually borrow to make capital expenditures. Holly Waite with the National Federation of Independent Business says with interest rates rising, some businesses are borrowing now instead of later.
Thinking through what financing might look like in the next few months may have accelerated those who were thinking about it, but hadn't gone through with purchasing.
Not every business needs to borrow. Steve Chu co-owns 2 fast casual sandwich shops in Baltimore called Ekiben, and he's about to open a third.
We're like a month or two out, and yeah, so we've had to buy a bunch of equipment.
That includes refrigerators, ranges, and fryers. And Chu is buying all of it with cash, which means he doesn't care about interest rates. On one hand, he says he feels like he's going broke. But on the other?
What we're seeing in the restaurant scene is like a big pivot from fine dining to more like fast casual, lower price point.
And opening a third location, chock full of shiny new equipment, will let him capitalize on that pivot. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, it was a mixed bag. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There is once again a very real possibility of a strike among freight railroad employees. Workers at the third largest railroad union have rejected a tentative contract deal with the major railroad companies. Those companies have a 24% raise on the table. Even so, working conditions are really the biggest sticking point, specifically what union members consider to be harsh schedules stemming from years of changes in the business. Marketplace's Lily Jamali tells us more.
The term precision railroading was pioneered by executive Hunter Harrison 3 decades ago. The idea was to make the rails more efficient and cut costs. Actual implementation of what he called the recipe was a bit mushier.
If you take and season that recipe with a little integrity and a lot of passion, you know what we're about. That's precision railroading.
And shareholders loved it. Harrison has since died, but the legacy of precision railroading includes steep job cuts, almost 30% over the last 6 years, says Sandra Dearden, CEO of High Road Consulting. When pandemic lockdowns ended, railroads tried to call back employees they'd furloughed.
And about half of them said they didn't want to come back because of the hours, work rules, and so forth.
Dearden says those rules let companies penalize workers for taking off sick. The Association of American Railroads says those concerns are partially addressed in a tentative agreement reached last month. Fully addressing scheduling concerns could be tricky given the 24% salary hike offered by the railroad companies, says Veronique de Rougy of George Mason's Mercatus Center.
It would be great if no trade-off existed, but it's not really the way it works.
By industry estimates, overall costs of a strike could reach $2 billion a day. Jason Miller of Michigan State says costs could be higher, exposing the coal, chemical, and auto industries most.
So those three sectors of the economy right away are going to essentially be crippled.
And he anticipates some companies could halt operations if there's no deal by next month. I'm Lily Dramali for Marketplace.
Now on to a technology story. You could say the demand for computers right now is crashing, and so are shipments of PCs. That's according to data from two different firms. Gartner says shipments are almost down 20% year over year, and the International Data Corporation says they're down 15%. Marketplace's Samantha Fields explains what's going on.
The last 2 years have been a roller coaster for a lot of companies, including those that make computers.
Now it's more heading towards the downturn of that ride.
Ryan Reese at IDC says earlier in the pandemic, there was a big spike in demand for PCs when so many people were working from home, going to school from home, and just staying home all the time.
But the huge growth we saw over the last 2+ years is coming to a big time slowdown.
Some of that is just because so many people have newish computers now and don't need to replace them yet.
It's also true that there are other things that are putting pressure on demand.
David Garfield at Alex Partners says what's happening in the economy more broadly is also a big factor.
Consumers see and feel inflation. Businesses do as well. And so people are a little less willing to part with their cash if they don't have to.
If they don't really need new electronics, they're not buying them now. Mikako Kitagawa at Gartner says that isn't great for companies that make and sell computers.
Because right now, inventory of PCs are very high.
There are a whole lot of laptops and desktops sitting on the shelves in stores and warehouses that businesses are trying to clear out. Sucharita Kadali at Forrester says that's good for anyone who is in the market for a computer.
If you have an interest in purchasing these products, go shop around. You should be getting a great deal.
Computers and other electronics, she says, are some of the only things that are actually cheaper right now than they were a year ago. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
So we told you yesterday on the show that the Social Security Administration will announce its cost of living adjustment later this week. This year, it's going to be the largest hike in more than 4 decades. Retirees can thank inflation for that. But, you know, here's the thing. Survey data tells us that as much as 25% of Americans, a quarter, are actually planning to delay retirement so that they can keep squirreling money away. Because retiring, it's not getting any cheaper. And that brings us to our latest installment of our series, My Economy.
My name is Susan Labarth. I'm a physician and I live in Montpelier, Vermont. And one of the things I'm doing for fun lately is planning my 80th birthday party. I graduated from Cornell with a degree in medieval history. Didn't see a career path that appealed to me. And entered Cornell's nursing school. But, you know, I just had this marvelous midlife crisis and just realized more and more strongly that I wasn't doing what I was supposed to be doing in life. and I had half my work life ahead of me. And so then I quit my job and borrowed a whole lot of money and turned 50 the day of my first exam in medical school. There you go. When I started paying off my school loans, I wasn't remotely thinking about retirement. I mean, I was just starting my career. So when I graduated, I think the loan was about $150,000. And when I finished residency, and I would have been, I think, about 56, I owed $200,000. But I've lived frugally, doing what I'm supposed to be doing, paid off my loans. Yeah, it took me 10 or 12 years. And, oh, I wasn't even thinking about retirement. My goodness. You know, when I started all this, I was in the mindset that I was halfway through my work life. So I had half my work life ahead of me. Oh, no, I wasn't even thinking about it. And I did think, I mean, I was approaching 60. It's time to start saving for retirement, yes. Although I wasn't thinking about not working. I was thinking about being prudent. And I finally got to the point where I didn't want to work full time, but I didn't want to give up what I was meant to be doing in this life. And so 1 or 2 days a week is fine because I can get the satisfaction of doing what I'm educated to do. But, you know, I'm in good health. My brain's still working okay, I think.
That was Susan LaBarth in Vermont. If you're listening to this, by the way, wishing you a very happy 80th birthday. Of course, this series only works because of you, so let us know what's going on in your economy over at marketplace.org/myeconomy. Coming up,
MapQuest. Like, that stuff is genius.
Yeah, you're telling me. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones inched up 36 points, 0.1% to close at 29,239. The Nasdaq fell 115 points, 1.1% to finish at 10,426. And the S&P 500 was down 23 points, 0.6% to end at 3588. GM is opening a new division devoted to selling electricity storage units and services. The company says it's hoping this will be a chance to generate new revenue from its work on electric vehicle batteries. GM stock fell 0.5%. In other news, the IMF just made a pretty gloomy forecast for the global economy in the year ahead. It blames the ongoing war in Ukraine, high interest rates, stubborn inflation, the continuing effects of the pandemic, shall I go on? The IMF predicts a global growth rate of just 2.7% for next year, down from July's estimate of 2.9%. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.93%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Rima Khreis. So out here in California, we are bracing for yet another dry winter as the drought drags on. It is, of course, a stressful time for farmers, especially those with water-loving crops like tomatoes. But some farmers, they have found a solution, and that is with hydroponic farming. This type of farming uses less than 10% of the water needed to grow tomatoes in the field. Seems like a no-brainer, right? For the planet, for the grocery bill. KCRW's Kaylee Wells explains how it's a bit more complicated than it seems.
Tomato farmer Scott Balick walks between rows of tomato vines that climb wires strung from the beams of a greenhouse. There's no soil. Their roots are submerged in little bags. So every drop of water he uses goes directly to the plant. He reaches down and pulls out a water dropper.
We're pretty precise. Our drippers are pressure compensated, and they're literally putting out half a gallon per hour.
When his grandfather started this farm back in the 70s, growing tomatoes inside greenhouses was a pretty radical idea. Now, about a third of fresh tomatoes grown domestically and then sold at a grocery store or a farmer's market are grown like this. But actually, that does not account for the bulk of the tomatoes grown in the U.S. Most tomato crops are processing tomatoes, meaning they get canned, bottled, and jarred into soups, ketchups, and salsas. And in that sector, hydroponics isn't catching on, says UC Davis agricultural economist Dan Sumner.
Because the labor and the capital of a greenhouse, for example, is so much more than the water cost is.
The processing tomatoes can be picked by machines. That holds down labor costs. Moving the tomatoes inside and using hydroponics would mean paying for people to pick them. Still, Sumner says over time, profitable farming in California will get harder. He says he's already seeing water-intensive crops like hay and corn leave the state. But he says tomatoes are safe for now.
There's a ways to go on those crops before we check off the boxes and get down to processing tomatoes.
And if ever it does get to that point, he says the tomatoes likely won't move to greenhouses. They'll move to somewhere like Mexico, where labor is cheaper.
I don't envision, and I haven't heard anyone talk about a period of time in which we'd grow indoor tomatoes in California for processing. It's much more likely that they might be grown somewhere else, some other part of the world.
Hydroponics has the best chance of catching on with the small local farms where big machines and international relocation aren't really an option. Scott Balick says it's most affordable for him to grow that way. After his outdoor competitors harvest the last of their summer crop, he keeps making money all winter long.
In a way, it balances out. We're able to grow 365 days. With that, you know, we're getting more crops. In the field, you're only going to do maybe one a year. Because it's seasoned. It's based on the season.
But hydroponics doesn't make financial sense for all growers. A few stalls down from the Balicks at the farmer's market, competitor Sunrise Organic Farms from Santa Barbara still grows its tomatoes outside. Samantha Watson with Sunrise Organic Farms points out that greenhouses are a big investment.
At the size that we are, they're very expensive. We deal with a lot of wind in our community as well. So, like, you could spend days building them, pay your whole crew, and then you get a bad wind, and you're like, well, there goes the greenhouses.
The vine-ripe tomatoes from Balick Farms and Sunrise Organic Farms both cost about $4 per pound at the farmer's market. For now, these two farms have come up with different ways to stay in the tomato business with the water they have. But as California's water continues to get more scarce, their calculations might have to change. In Southern California, I'm Kaylee Wells for Marketplace.
So a couple years back, at the start of the pandemic, I talked with someone for the Marketplace podcast that I host. This is uncomfortable. And he struck me as someone who was eternally optimistic, with every reason not to be. As he put it, he'd spent 17 years, 6 months, 2 days, and 35 minutes being wrongly convicted of a crime he didn't commit. He was in college, 20 years old when he was arrested, and he was 37 when he was released. You know, Kevin, he is, of course, far from the first or only person to be wrongfully convicted. According to data from the Innocence Project, a nonprofit for criminal justice reform, it's estimated that 1% of the U.S. prison population, so about 20,000 people, are falsely convicted. In the last 30 years, less than 3,000 have been exonerated in the U.S. I recently called up Kevin to see how he's doing today. Kevin, welcome to the show.
Hey, how's it going? Thanks for having me again.
Yeah, man, it's been like, what, 2 years, I think, since we first talked. We chatted right when you've been exonerated in April of 2020. So I'm really excited to talk with you. And my first question is just, how are you? How are things going?
Well, I have a son. He'll be 1 year old next week, actually. So, you know, everybody's parents know. That keeps you on your toes.
Oh, man. I can't imagine. Yeah.
And doing a lot of stuff in the community with my nonprofit. You know, we do Coke giveaways, toy giveaways around Christmas time, Thanksgiving meals. And this will be our third year through all the holidays and stuff like that.
Wow. So many life updates. And so you've got that nonprofit. What other goals do you have for your career?
Well, so I started also a consulting firm, Justice Group Consulting Firm, LLC. Mm-hmm. Where I help guys that's still incarcerated, you know, they're claiming their innocence, helping them find their paperwork, helping them, you know, do some digging to, you know, unearth some of those things that I had to prove my innocence.
No, that's amazing. It sounds like you want to be the kind of resource you wish you had, earlier
on. Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I also sit on a board of organization of exonerees where other people that was wrongly convicted in the state of Michigan, we all band together so we can help one another out. It's kind of like a brotherhood because we understand what we went through and where we are now.
I remember when we last chatted, we talked about how in the state of Michigan, where you were convicted and where you still live today, people who are released from prison after a wrongful conviction like yours are entitled to $50,000 for each year that was served. So in your case, 17 years.
Right.
Have you gotten that money yet?
Yes.
How has that money allowed you to rebuild your life?
Well, I don't believe there's no monetary funds that they can give someone for kidnapping, essentially taking someone away from their family or loved ones and essentially stopping their life.
Yeah.
Yes, money helps. I didn't have a lot of skill sets to be able to just hop back into the workforce like someone that just finished college, so to speak. So, you know, the money helps, you know, moving those type of things along and being able to, you know, find yourself a little bit, be able to pay your bills and things of that nature. And, you know, just try to enjoy life a little bit, you know, what you have left.
So you've also filed a federal lawsuit against some local detectives for about $160 million. And it seems like y'all are in the middle of that right now. You know, practically that money, I mean, obviously would be huge. But symbolically, what would that mean to get that compensation?
It would mean justice. It would mean that the hand of justice really works. It would mean that the hands of justice is human, meaning we make mistakes, but we rectify them. That's what that money means. So no amount of money in the world that someone can give someone to say, well, hey, you lost loved ones, you missed funerals because you was forced not to be here. It was mental torture. How do you supposed to uproot that and just carry on like nothing ever happened?
What's been the most difficult part of putting your life back together?
So, you know, you have to relearn things. Like today I told my girlfriend, actually, the backup camera, you know, like when you're trying to back up in your car, is like one of the best inventions.
I know, right?
It would have took me like 10 hours to parallel park. You know, so like things like that, just, you know, the small things like, you know, using the iPhone MapQuest, like that stuff is genius.
I remember when we last talked, you were really optimistic and really just like taking in the smaller joys of day-to-day life. And now that it's been 2 years since you've been released, what's a surprising source of joy lately for you?
I love going to the fitness gym. Like it's very cool. There's a lot of stuff to do. They even have a daycare in there. So
amazing.
You know, they can watch my son. So those small things, I enjoy walking around my community. Sightseeing, you know, I still feel like a foreigner almost. Like, I like different smells and different hustle and bustles. And I just love just being around in the mix of it. Every day is just a blessing.
Kevin Harrington, it's been a real pleasure talking with you. Thanks for coming on the show. I am, you know, wishing you and your family the best of luck.
Appreciate you. Thanks for having me. And we need to do this more often. We need to do like a 90-day update or something. Like,
you know, every 90 days, we just check in. I am down,
Kevin. Let's do a 90-day. Kevin Harrington, what are you doing now? You know?
What's going on? Also, if you want to hear more of Kevin's story, including what it was like for him when he was first released back in April of 2020, you should check out the Marketplace podcast I host called This is Uncomfortable. His episode is titled From Prison to Pandemic. Thanks so much, Kevin.
Appreciate you.
This final note on the way out today, kind of story you'd file under the category of, oh, yeah, well, that makes sense. Axios reports that TikTok is planning something that might very well come into competition with Amazon, one of our underwriters, by the way. TikTok wants to build its own product fulfillment centers here in the U.S., basically create an e-commerce supply chain system to help sellers keep selling. The thing is, the social media giant has already introduced a bunch of e-commerce features, But they are clearly doubling down on these efforts, trying to leverage the well-known fact that the app already dominates hours and hours and hours of our collective time. All right, we've got to go. No time for a moment of economic context. You'll have to find your own. Our digital and on-demand team includes Carrie Barber, Dylan Metinen, Janet Nguyen, Olga Oxman, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. Francesca Levy is the executive director, and I'm Rima Chreis. We'll be back tomorrow. This is APM.